the efficiency of a CVC as an innovation tool is, and there's also many studies, by a factor better than any other activity a corporate can do in order to be innovative. All the other activities have their merits, but they are much less capital efficient.
Hello, and welcome to the CVC Unplugged podcast from GCV. I'm Fernando Moncada. For Crispin Like, managing director of ENBW New Ventures, a passion for energy technology came early in life and was supercharged later on when he became a father and saw his time horizons change from years to generations ahead. As the head of energy generation and utility company ENBW's corporate venturing unit, Like and his team focus on three main areas where they can have the biggest impact, namely electrification, digitalization, and decentralization of the energy system. He joined me on the podcast to talk about ENBW's approach to these areas and how the energy investment landscape has changed. We also dove into a number of learnings that he's taken as he embarks on his 15th year as a CVC investor. We talk about why he advocates for an evergreen fund structure, the reasons for which go far beyond just the ability to be patient with one's capital, as well as the value that CVCs can get from taking LP positions in other funds, why he believes that CVCs should focus primarily on the financial end of the spectrum, and perhaps most interestingly, why he believes, unlike many other CVC practitioners, that corporate venturing units would do well to report to a CFO. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe to CVC Unplugged, and above all, enjoy the show. So Crispin, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Fernando. It's great to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation. It's very kind.
No, absolutely. As I was speaking off mic, you know, I've been following your kind of recent LinkedIn posts, and I found them really interesting. And also, I think you're one of the first kind of energy CVCs we've had on the show. So I think there's a lot of ground to cover over the next kind of 40-60 minutes or so.
Looking very much forward to.
And I suppose maybe we can start off with a bit about yourself. Kind of, you know, I know you were at if I'm not mistaken. From one of your LinkedIn posts, you're going into your 15th year as a CVC. I know you were with Innergy before, and now with ENBW, of course. You know, tell us a bit about your story. How'd you get to where you are today?
Yeah, maybe I start a little bit at a different angle. So first of all, I'm 50 years old, so a little dinosaur already.
Not at all.
And I'm married, and I have four kids, and that brings me actually to sort of the first point that is really important to me, that's the family. Maybe I'm not different than many others in that respect, but yeah, the family plays an important role in my life. And when you have four kids, you know, you just look also different on certain aspects of what you're doing in business and also what might be the consequence for the next generation. So this whole idea of sustainability and circular economy and stuff, that's something that is, for me, not just an idea or a theoretical concept, but it's really a purpose. My family is giving me sort of this, stability, but also sort of the reason to drive these things, not just for my own lifetime, but really also for the next generation. So that's maybe sort of the first anchor that I really want to emphasize before we go to all these sort of professional stuff. So, when I look on what I've done in business, actually, you mentioned energy. Energy is really the cornerstone. My thinking was very simplistic in a way. So basically, my thought from early on was, if we solve the energy equation in a sustainable way, then, well, we can solve all the other questions too, because they basically are just a derivation, or they just come afterwards. So basically, if you have sustainable energy at your hands, then you can transform it into whatever you need. And that is why I always thought, oh, I would love to actually contribute a little bit there and work in that field. And that brings you, I was actually studying chemical engineering. So I'm a chemical engineer by training. And when at the student times, when I told this to my friends, they were like, wow, you want to go into the energy utility industry? So you want to get into retirement from day one or what? Because it was at the time, of course, all completely regulated and so on. So, and I said, well, yeah, it might sound weird, but still, I think this is where I want to go. And then, I mean, you know that what happened in the last 26 years now, it's just amazing. But there is sort of this second piece. So So first piece, family, second piece, energy, third piece is then what, and this is something, of course, that just happened, and I had no crystal ball to know about this, but all these technological changes. So for example, the renewables was, of course, a big, big technology development. And I actually got in touch with renewables very early at school already when I saw a video from BASF, the big chemical giant at the time. And they actually had put sort of sunlight on a plastic sheet and then sort of total reflecting the sunlight into a sort of concentrated beam. And then they had put very small photovoltaic modules behind. And that was 89, so that was basically space tech. It was incredibly expensive. And I just saw this video and I thought, if this works, this would be just great. So that was the point where I started to think that renewables actually could be a great solution for the future. It took much, much longer than I thought at the time, actually, but but here we are. And then when I really started in business, after I started as 97, And then actually in 99 came this whole liberalization with, I worked at Enron for the time, so really driving new things. And I know Enron has good and bad things, but it was quite, for me as a young professional, it was quite an experience. And what I saw there, Enron had at the time like the largest, it was called Enron Online, the largest over-the-counter trading platform in the cloud already. And that was amazing technology. And so that was sort of this point in time where I thought, okay, it's not just energy. There's also telecommunication. There's information technology. So if these things converge, then something new can actually come out of this. So that was sort of the second piece that I was putting into my technology thinking and landscape. And yeah, I mean, just on a side note, I'm really still thankful to Enron because they actually allowed me to pursue also an MBA. So I was lucky to get into a program with them doing in parallel to working GSB Chicago MBA. And, you know, in my generation, MBA was still cool. I don't know how it is today. But also these things constantly change. I guess today it would be much more important that you can code than to have an MBA. So that is this piece. And I only entered then into the renewables 2002 when this was becoming bigger business. And was then working in the renewables areas in different functions, wind turbine manufacturer, wind turbine projects, but also helping a utility to actually bring all their renewable assets into one entity and so stuff like that. And then it was sort of around 2009. And that was another point in time where one of these technological moments where I thought, oh my gosh, what is happening here? I was just by coincidence, I was asked if I wanted to take a test drive in a Tesla Roadster. And I was not allowed to drive myself. I was just on the
Is this the first generation Roadster?
Yes, the very first one that was really still sort of, I don't know how they did that, but it was really handmade and so the really very small car, this Lotus Elise based thing. And this experience was just amazing. You know, I went back into my team and I basically told, forget about everything what I've said about electric driving or electric cars, because it will happen. Yeah, this is just amazing. And of course, there are many. I mean, one is the performance, but there were also many other things where I thought, okay, no local emissions. You have the possibility to bring renewable electricity actually into the mobility sector and all these things that this is combined. And so this whole electrification of the transport sector is then sort of the next big piece where I was really impressed and I thought, okay, this is great what is happening. Well, and now, I mean, today, you know, even like today, if you combine these different things, you have right now for the renewables, there's still a lot to do for the renewable rollout, but there's also batteries now. Battery is a huge topic for us, for example, where we are trying to see, okay, what can startups do there? How can they help? And another thing is that the more renewables you have, you need price signals. You need, in order, supply demand somehow has to come together. And this is where sort of the classic regulatory energy system is at the edge. Yeah? I mean, they're just not used to it. And we are a strong believer in price signals. And then last but not least, also the heating will be electric. So even it continues to spread basically like a little virus into all the different sectors. And this is, of course, great. So that's the third piece. And then comes the final piece that I want to mention. And the fourth one is, And that is this human ingenuity in a way. And that I translate this into entrepreneurs, because entrepreneurs actually bring sort of all these things together. And and if you want to combine energy, technology, and entrepreneurship, and if you're like me, I have no own idea, or in the sense I never thought that I would build sort of my own technology startup or so, then you end up with the thinking, okay, so what can I do? What can I contribute? And basically, I decided that I raise capital from two utilities. Yeah? So now ENBW is the second utility that I was able to raise money from, and actually to invest this into startups in this field. And for ENBW New Ventures, like the three megatrends that we're investing into is electrification, digitization, and decentralization. So basically, how can these startups with digital, sometimes also with sensors and with a little bit hardware, but how can they actually enable the rollout and the whole energy and transport transformation with their solutions, and helping some large corporates that are maybe not always the fastest in these topics to sort of realize the overall transformation together faster. And that's the core thesis. But maybe this is enough a little bit about sort of the basic drivers that I have.
No, that's fascinating. And you know, few countries I think are a better place to develop a passion for renewable energy than Germany, right? And to your point about price signals, you know, in a past life, I was working at another publication focused on energy and infrastructure. And one of the kind of ongoing themes was how German onshore wind kind of tender competitions were very kind of, you know, were getting low interest because the prices were already so low. You know, it was almost a victim of its own success. So it's really interesting to kind of see how that has evolved. And I wonder from an investor's point of view, and you said a lot of things there that I really want to touch on, but from an investor's point of view, as like a VC, how have you noticed the investment landscape change from when you started, say, at Energy to where things are now?
Well, I mean, this is constantly changing, as you know. I mean, the investor landscape is really always about sort of the hot topic, and then everyone is piling in. And I still remember, I think the first big trend that I saw, so I started with CVC 15 years ago, I think there it was still called sort of all the nanotechnology stuff. And then came other trends. And I think what is really, really important is that at the end of the day, and this is what we did and what I personally always did, is I was trying to focus on a sector where I think a lot of change can happen, where there is sort of a huge also societal pressure that this change is actually happening, making lives better. And then you actually look for the right solutions and specialize in this sector. And this sector will be in, and then it will be out, and then we will be back in. So I think I'm in the third wave of clean tech interest right now, with new investors piling in. And every time it feels a little bit different, you know. I think the first wave was pure technology stuff, pure technology stuff. The second wave was more about including also asset and asset rollout. And now the third wave is really interesting, because what I see now in the third wave is that for the first time, it's very broad. So a very broad investor base, also driven by institutionals, pushing for these sort of sustainable solutions. Maybe this whole ESG thing is also behind this, sort of as a further enabler. And I think it's much more, you know, it's you as an investor, you can now really decide in this whole sustainable or green tech or whatever you want to call it now, where they want to position themselves. So there are so many different startups, different types of business models that you can actually focus as an investor on what you think works best with your thesis, with your investors behind sort of your LPs, in order to realize what they expect from it, being it from asset rollout to pure digital business models to deep tech. I mean, you can really choose, because there's so many opportunities right now.
You mentioned earlier the three pillars of your thesis. So those were electrification, digitization, and decentralization. And I think most people will be familiar with the first two, right? The electrification and digitization. But I would suspect they are less familiar with the concept of decentralization, right? Most people might assume that for the most part, they're correct, that energy goes from the power station to the home, and that's about it. But that model has been changing, right? And the future really is decentralized. Can you talk about that pillar a bit?
Yeah, of course, happy to do so. I think That's, if you look into history, that's actually full circle. So when we started to use energy as human beings, it was really about, you know, the famous fire, and you use wood and you just heat your home. And then we were discovering the sort of more energy density through coal, oil, and natural gas. And we were using this. And in order to make best use of this higher density fuels, basically, it made absolute sense to build very large central stations, power stations, in order to sort of push this fuel through and then to distribute it basically through different means, through the power grid, for example, then in terms of electricity. And this is sort of the industry how it is. It comes from sort of very large central power stations, and these power stations provide the electricity. I mean, I'm talking about the electricity market. There's, of course, different markets out there, but electricity is sort of the cornerstone for us. And this was sort of driving from the very large, from high voltage power lines going down through then lower voltage up to the household. And basically, the household is asking for electricity and the system provides it. That was sort of one way street from the large central stations to the households and the industry. Now, the current system and with the renewables, what has happened is that first there came like wind farms. They are more like at the middle voltage levels. The larger ones and small wind farms, maybe even at the lower voltage. And then came photovoltaic, and photovoltaic is something that, well, from sort of larger scale plants to really putting the modules on your house, everything is there. So all of a sudden, you're talking about basically every house is not just asking for electricity, getting it, but every house is transformed into a type of a prosumer, how it's called, that it is not only taking electricity, it can also generate electricity. And with this, all of a sudden, you have a situation where on the lowest level grid, electricity is generated and fed into the system, and you need to balance this. And you sometimes even need to push electricity back up because you have too much in the lower grid. And this means that all of a sudden the whole system is not one-way street, but it's two-way street. It has to be very flexible, and you have to apply a completely different thinking on how to balance the grid, how to balance supply demand. And you start not from the large power station and then you dribble down, but you basically start from the household and then to the street and then to the region, and then you go just the other way around. And this requires completely new digital technologies, because there's a lot of data that needs to be exchanged. Before you had just whatever, 20 power stations to manage, and now you have millions of small assets that generate electricity. And there, I think there's still a lot to do, a lot of new ideas that can be followed. If you take virtual power plants, or if you taking all the batteries now that are all of a sudden also in households. So this is a new world, and there's a lot to do out there. And in every country, it's a little bit different. Right? It depends on how strong your grid is. Like the US looks completely different than continental Europe, for example. But yeah, but it's very interesting topic.
Well, I mean, you guys are certainly, you know, working to do your part, right? So if I'm not mistaken, you focus on Series A and beyond, right? Investing in, I think, with ticket sizes of between 1 and 10 million euros. Is that right?
Yeah, that's perfectly right.
And do you avoid kind of seed stage? Is the risk just too much there, I suppose?
Yeah, it's the question of how we are investing is of course connected to who we are, as we are a CVC. And that probably brings us a little bit to the different topics of, because I've of course 15 years of CVC, so I've tried and learned a little bit about different structures that you can actually set up as a CVC and how they work and maybe also not work so well. And I'm trying now with these links with these posts on LinkedIn, I'm trying to sort of, well, share what I've learned and maybe help others, because there are so many new CVCs coming up. I mean, this is when I started with CVC 15 years ago, it was, I don't know, I think in Germany, of the 100 largest German companies, maybe there were two or three CVCs. And today there's probably 60 or so for the 100 largest companies. So it's just a huge development. And every week there are new units set up, and I'm trying to sort of share a little bit these findings. And there, I think the very first question, I mean, you now came with a maturity. So just to answer this question, maybe in very short, we are trying to be a little bit later stage because if you have seed, we also try to sort of open the doors of our corporate, not as a must, but as a can. And if it's a seed company, it's quite difficult for a very large corporation, especially for a utility that is per se using technology that is well proven and that works for 20 years and so on. It's very difficult to get more than just the investment to really embrace cooperation if it's so early stage. This is why we go a little bit later. So we want to see commercial solutions that have already the first logos that is sort of in the first growth phase. And so Series A typically. It's not that we never do a little bit earlier if we sort of love the team, but it's typically Series A and then going into B.
That makes sense. And geographically, you tend to stay within Europe, right? Is there is that an imperative, or is, you know, for example, if the opportunity or technology is right elsewhere, is that still a no?
It's an imperative. The reason is we are active investors, so we do not take like 1%. We tend to take with the first round maybe 5-6%, and then going into the sweet spot up to 15% with consortia, of course, sometimes lead, sometimes co. But we want to really engage with the team, engage with our experts, help them, connect them. And our own added value as an investor is strongest in DACH and also in Europe. So honestly, it's not that we do not think that in the US or in Israel or somewhere else are really, really very good startups, maybe sometimes even better startups. But there's also great investors and they can help these startups maybe better than we could. So it's more about, okay, bringing our own value proposition together with sort of the for the founder team is most important, and we can help them best in Europe.
Talk me through that process of assessing where you kind of determine you can have the greatest impact in terms of where you deploy your capital.
Yeah, I mean, the first and very important point we have already discussed, these three megatrends, where we have just said, okay, it sounds like very general, but in fact, when you look at the deal flow, it's a must that the startup actually fits at least into one of these three megatrends. Why do we do this? Because we do believe that it's so incredibly difficult to build a successful startup that it really helps if you have some megatrends as a tailwind that help you a little bit and not that you're trying to go against. So for example, a startup that would improve an engine that is burning gas oil or so, improving the efficiency, that's a great task. That's fantastic. But it would be really nothing for us because it's not electrification. For us, this is sort of something where the mega trend is pointing in a different direction. Yeah. So they can build a great business and so on. But we want to have stuff that sort of is going with these as a tailwind. The second thing is that we have, of course, looked at EnBW and thought, okay, what is the core business model of our corporate backer? And that is owner and operator of infrastructure. That's the core business model of our corporate backer. And therefore, we are looking for startups that actually, and this is what I mentioned before, through their solutions can actually enable that the rollout of this huge infrastructures that we need for the energy transformation, for the mobility transformation, for the heat transformation, that they somehow support this, such a business model. Yeah. For example, it's sometimes easier to explain what we not do. If you have, for example, a battery company. A battery company could be like a new battery chemistry, yeah? Just a new mix of building a battery, lithium, air, or whatever. Yeah? Something completely new. While as an engineer, I of course think I love technology, but we would basically say, okay, that's not for us. Instead, we would look for companies that actually build on this big trend of the battery rollout, completely independent of which technology it actually will be. So we're not betting on technology, but we're betting on the battery rollout. And then we're looking, and we've just invested into one called Volytica Diagnostics in Dresden, in Germany. They are basically taking all the data from the battery management system in order to determine if the battery is secure and safe and within their limits. And they can determine also wear and tear of the battery. So basically, if you own and operate a battery in the market, you want to optimize it, you want to make most money out of it. And they basically can ensure that you're not harming your asset in a way. Yeah? So these are the things that we would invest in. So that's sort of the thing. And then the third and the most important, so these are sort of more the external trends and business model logic. And then the core, we are a CVC, and in CVC is VC, and VC is about the very classic. So we look very, very heavily on the team, what they have done in the past, what they want to do, what's their vision, what abilities they have, how do they work together, and these things. So the classic sort of the team, but then of course also, how's the traction? Is the business model already commercial? What's the raw margin? We focus on very high margin businesses. And what logos do they have? We talk to the customers. So this is classic VC business, basically. So we are really a financially driven CVC. But maybe this would bring me to one point that I would love to elaborate a little bit here, because this is one of these things in 15 years of CVC that I'm sort of confronted, or that I'm bumping against again and again and again. And this is this this key question: if a CVC should be strategic or return driven, you know, a financial or strategic. And this question comes again and again, and I'm looking on this, and my first reaction is always, well, if you're asking me strategic or financial, my personal view is the question is wrong.
Yeah, would a fair assessment then of perhaps your view on that be that you focus on the strategic, on the financial, and then the strategic will naturally follow from that? Is that kind of how you look at it?
I would say yes. The point is a little bit that it is always an end. And I think people have to be very clear on why is a corporate setting up a CVC unit. Yeah. So I can bring the example of ENBW. We have a 100 million commitment. We are financially driven. ENBW is a company that is making sort of EBITDA in the billions. Yeah. So 3-4 billion. And we are a 100 million fund. If you would assume that we have 50% capital deployed, 50 million, if we would make 20% return, we would bring 10 million per annum. 10 million per annum would be a nice financial result compared to billions. So it doesn't move the needle. Yeah? So, and that's sort of this big argument where you always, yes, it doesn't move the needle. And then comes my big but. You have to honor the financially driven business model, because otherwise, I mean, what we offer is that we are able to choose startups in a sector, in fields that are of strategic importance to ENBW, where they can sort of work with these and cooperate with these, and down the road, maybe even through an M&A process, which would be market-based, buy these. But we basically bridge the time and we select successful startups. And we can only prove this not through some strategic KPIs or so, but just through return, through showing that these companies really grow like hell, that they have very high margins, that they are successful, and that they, at the end of the day, appreciate in value. And this is why it's always so difficult to explain that, well, ENBW is doing it for strategic reasons, because they have understood there are people out there, and they are very, very important, like the entrepreneurial teams that I've mentioned, that would never work for ENBW. It's a great company, but it's a large corporate. There are people out there that are really great in execution, in finding the best solutions, in combining technology with the needs of the customer, but these are entrepreneurial teams. And as a big corporate, if you want to get in touch with them, if you want to cooperate, if you want to embrace sort of their speed and their abilities, you cannot hire them. So you have to find a different way of cooperation. And corporate venture capital is one of these tools that you can actually use. So I would always say it's an and, but the CVC unit is purely financial, and the strategic link is established by the corporate through different means, not by trying to push single deals because they're strategic, but by setting the frame of the unit in form of an investment strategy. But within this frame, there has to be a lot of freedom to actually pursue the most successful startups and to invest into them, and to then open the doors, but in an open way to the corporate, because the corporation, if the corporate wants to cooperate and the startup wants to cooperate, you know, both can say no or yes. It has to be their choice. But of course, what we can offer, if we are investors, that we have a relationship, that we have a trust base, with these teams. And we have a trust base with our LP backer, ENBW. And so what we see is that many, many times, it's like there are misunderstandings, you know, and this is what we can moderate. We will never moderate a negotiation or any commercial agreement or so. That's something for sort of the both parties to solve on their own. But this is how we sort of look on this. And what we see is that many CVCs still emphasize first strategy. And also what we see many times is that many C-level executives are still misunderstanding the CVC tool as we can then tell the startup what to do because we know what is right to do. A corporate has a lot of experience and they know many, many things. But that's not the function of a CVC to tell the startup what they should do. It's the other way around. I mean, the entrepreneurs drive the business and the CVC gives sparring partner perspectives of what we have seen, what has worked, what has not worked with other companies. But at the end of the day, the founder team, the entrepreneur team has to decide. Otherwise, they are not accountable anymore. That just doesn't work.
So how does that how does the kind of heavy financial focus affect, in your view, the way you look at, say, taking a portfolio view on the financial return, right? So some other investors might say, for example, you know, we're comfortable, you know, maybe taking a loss on a few of them, you know, with a power law, most of your returns will come from a minority of your investments, and you can take learnings from those that perhaps didn't do as well. But is it imperative then from your point of view that almost every investment, you know, obviously you want every investment to be successful, right?
Yes.
But is that, you know, would you be satisfied with an overall portfolio good financial return, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's not our approach that every company has to be successful. I mean, we're going a little bit later stage because, you know, a seed risk is a different one than a Series A risk. On the other hand, if you would take our single investment risk compared to sort of what ENBW is used to, we are a huge risk taker compared to what traditionally a utility would do. Still, we are an investor. So we do believe, as said before, we do believe in sustainable solutions. And for us, sustainable solutions is also that the way how the startup operates is not sort of pushing 1 billion into marketing and then hoping one day to turn it around. That's, some people can do this extremely successful. It's no good or bad, but it's not us. We wouldn't do these things. We're looking much more for really teams that have a great execution that also see that, okay, if I raise another 5 million, then I have to weigh this against the how much can I grow? Yeah. How much does my pie get bigger and how much do I get diluted? So, I mean, this is what should be done. And so I would not qualify us as a unicorn hunter, but more like we love radical execution. We love a lot of growth. So we want our startups on average to grow. Well, each startup in our portfolio should grow 100% per annum. That's sort of what we're expecting. Not every startup maybe gets this done, but most of our startups actually realize this also. So we are a growth investor, but we're not sort of at the extremes of that we've seen, especially in the last years, where there was a lot of money in the market. For us, having an idea about how this company actually can be also profitable is always sort of in our head. If it grows very strong, it's of course logic that it's okay to make losses. But we have a sustainable view also on the corporation as such, on the startup as such, and burning money all day long for 20 years in a row is something that we would qualify as unsustainable.
Right. And I know you're a big advocate of the evergreen fund structure, right? As opposed to, you know, your typical 12, you know, 15 or 10 year fund. What freedom does that give you to then, you know, execute on the strategy as you've laid it out?
Yeah, I think the evergreen, I mean, there are some evergreens out there that are arguing for, especially for green tech, that evergreen is the right solution. But the reason for that is more like, okay, green tech takes longer. And this is why they want to have this freedom of being longer engaged. That's not the reason for us. The reason is a different one. I think, and that's again, a corporate VC specialty. When you go to the board of a corporate, and you basically tell them, okay, we will provide you with this open innovation tool, and we need 100 million. And then they give you 100 million. And then you come back after 5 years and you say, okay, we have been quite successful. It's now 5 years, so I have not really many exits yet. But yeah, believe me, I just need another 200 million and I then make it even more successful. And the big or the nice advantage of the evergreen is actually that you can go to the board and say, okay, I need 100 million and that's it. With this, I will build you.
Recycle.
Exactly. I will recycle the money. And the nice thing is our own business model is a closed loop business model. So if we are successful through the exits, we grow, we get larger. I can hire more people. We can invest into more startups. So this grows. This gives a perspective for the team itself that we are controlling our own business model and not after every 10 years or every 5 years, we run to someone and beg for more money. And it allows also to the corporate to tell them, okay, we just need your initial 100 million commitment and the commitment that if we generate profits out of this, that we can keep these profits. So you own indirectly, they own, of course, the whole entity. So they profit also from these profits because we are getting larger and we are getting more valuable. But they don't get sort of, they get the cash, of course, immediately back, but we can redraw it when we redeploy it into other startups. And this is why we initially started and said, okay, we invest into 10 to 15. And now we can basically invest into 25 to 30 because we have invested into 18 startups. We have already successfully sold 5, 1 to ENBW actually, which is also nice, but 4 also to the market, to other large corporates. These were quite nice exits, not yet sort of this unicorn stuff, but helps us, of course, to be profitable now already 3 years in a row and to grow. So we could grow the team. We can grow sort of the future portfolio. So yeah, and this makes the evergreen a very easy to understand solution. And of course, there's also the other way around. If we would be not successful, I have to fire also someone. We have to decrease the team and we have a smaller portfolio. So both way rounds, but the corporate would never risk more than the initial commitment, basically.
Right, yeah. And how much of would you say of the profit gets recycled?
Well, I mean, for us, it's basically we can keep all the profits. So it's really the commitment. And that is something, of course, that needs to be negotiated with the corporate at the end of the day. You could, of course, do this model. You could say, okay, the corporate want to have step by step also his initial commitment back. But for ENBW, as we are, you heard how large ENBW is, 25,000 people, 70 billion turnover, 3-5 billion EBITDA. So for them, the 100 million is a size of a commitment where they basically say, okay, if you're successful, you can keep it and you build it and you make it larger. So they're not expecting this back. But of course, I mean, we have to also pay our team and all these things. That's for sure.
And of course, for any CVC, this is true, but maybe for a model like yours, even more so, that you know, this requires a good relationship with the C-suite. And that kind of brings me to one of the more kind of interesting and intriguing LinkedIn posts that I've read from yours that I really wanted to dig into because it cuts against the grain, which I really love. And that is the about reporting lines. And you argue that CVC should report to the CFO and to a lot of investors, and I'm sure many of those listening, that might sound a bit counterintuitive, right? That maybe they would say that's what you should avoid, in fact, reporting to the CEO or even having a CFO on the investment committee at all. And not because they're bad or anything, but just because they have a job to do, right? And you know, and while we certainly can't begrudge them that job, right? Maybe it would be regarded, you know, if I were to paraphrase an argument that I've heard as being, you know, perhaps counterproductive to the mission of the CVC. Maybe it's too financially focused or too, you know, quarterly cycle driven, mm-hmm. or focused on short-term wins, what have you, et cetera, et cetera. Mm. But yeah, why do you feel then that is like the natural, you know, point of contact in the C-suite for a CVC?
Yeah, I actually did this post because I saw a post from Ilya from Stanford. And he basically was showing a statistic about to whom is the CVC actually reporting. And it was like a zoo. CEO, CFO, strategy VP, chief innovation officer, chief technology officer, CTO, everything was on there, really everything. And I thought, ooh, that is surprising because actually we have a setup and there again. So of course, in our case, we are reporting to the CFO and this works incredibly well. Now, when I got all these comments, there were also some comments about, yeah, what a CFO is like. And of course, this plays a role. I think there are very different types of CFOs. I, of course, with this post, had a CFO in mind that sees himself not as a, I'm against every business and I need to keep everyone under control, but more as an enabler that is ensuring that the capital efficiency in the corporation is maximized. Yeah? As an enabler to the business, of course, there is a control element, but really watching the efficiency. And the efficiency as of a CVC as an innovation tool is, and there's also many studies, by a factor better than any other activity a corporate can do in order to be innovative. All the other activities have their merits, but they are much less capital efficient. And this is why I think it's a very logical step that this is then connected to a CFO that is actually monitoring capital efficiency. But let me also just one step back, because I wrote reporting to the CFO, and maybe also my post was there not exact enough, because what I meant is, you know, that I'm also an advocate for a separate legal entity with separate governance structure. So you don't want to have your transactions discussed with the C-level corporation people. They have more important things to do, much larger deals to do. And when you look at your transactional investment committee, you want to have people that have transactional know-how, that have investor know-how, that have founder know-how, these things. And this is how we have set up our investment committee. We have no business unit in there because you don't want to have this competition or conflict of interest stuff. So that's the investment committee as such. But we are sort of the unit as such is connected to the CFO. So basically, he's our shareholder representative. So that means I do not discuss with him every little deal, but I discuss with him the big strategic things and sort of the overall direction. And of course, also the fund KPIs, yeah? TVPI, DPI, the capital outlay, even sometimes also sort of the average growth rate, the burn rates overall, and so on in the startups. And this is all financial data. It's financial stuff. So I think it's quite difficult if you want to a CTO to sort of explain to him how a fund is operated, how you mentioned portfolio management. For a CFO, it's clear he has a portfolio, so he will immediately understand and will not want to dive into each little single startup. That's not his task. So in that sense, and I'm just very, very lucky. We have a CFO, Thomas Kusterer, who is a very modern CFO. He just got voted CFO of the year here in Germany. So he knows the VC business model. I never needed to explain this in any way. He knows the risks associated with this. This is why he wants to have a very professional setup so that these risks are managed well. He's not anti-risk. He's anti-unmanaged risks or intransparent risks. And this is where I think it has worked very, very well. And at the end of the day, we have 100 million of risk capital of the corporation that we are managing and growing, and we have a hurdle rate, because otherwise, you know, that the corporation is deploying this into our vehicle, we need to bring the return. And there again, I think the CFO is the right one to judge if we're doing a good job there or not.
That's interesting. And I think the risk point, I think, is the real crucial one that I think many other investors might think that other CFOs might lack, that understanding of as long as it's managed, it's okay, essentially. And I think, you know, if that understanding is there, then that's, I think. And having your CFO be a CFO of the year, that's a pretty cool feather to have in your cap, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And of course, you have to be also, and this is what I want to mention also, when you build a CVC, you have to be a little bit lucky in a way, because the moment that you start it, I mean, we all know that you need 5, 6, 7 years of trust that you are allowed to build it. You can be lucky, of course, that after 3 years you have some early exits or so to prove the point, but you need to have this time frame. And there it's, I think, incredibly important that when you're setting it up, that you are talking to all the C-level board members, that you understand what is their view on this tool, what do they expect from it. But then when it comes to, okay, where should the unit reside? I would always suggest the CFO, because the license to operate and the capital that you are employing. And it's an investor business model. It's a financial business model. So I was quite surprised about the reaction that people thought that the CFO is maybe not the right one. So interesting reaction, yeah.
No, yeah, and exactly. No, and I think that's it's a lot of food for thought for a lot of, especially CVCs that are starting out. And I want to ask you about you know, some advice you'd give to some founders and some new CVCs. But before that, I just want to, I know that you have also a fund of funds mandate. And I was wondering, how do you kind of approach that? And if you have any, examples of how you've been able to apply that learning to your own direct investments.
Yeah, the fund sort of if a CVC should invest into other funds, that's one of these other topics where I must really say that I learned. So when I started 15 years ago, I was actually very much convinced that you shouldn't do that, that you should go direct. Why? Because if you want, large corporations, they have asset management, they have pension monies and so on. They do invest into funds passively. Yeah? So they're doing this anyhow. So if you're building a CVC, I think you have to make clear that this is not another pension money vehicle or something like this, but this is an active contributor to the core business of the future, an active innovation push to actually get answers on really big questions and further transformation needs of the corporate down the road. And in order to ensure that, I was convinced that only direct investments can do so. Because if you're indirect, then you're like, well, you're like pension money. And this is why I thought going direct is the key. I have not completely changed my mind in the way that I think the vast majority of the activity should be direct investments. Because when it's about enabling cooperation, when it's about later M&A, when it's about this trust, building trust with these teams, with the entrepreneurs, having the direct contact to the entrepreneurs, that's key. Now comes the but. What I've learned is, of course, that in my arrogance 15 years ago, maybe I haven't seen this, is you need to become part of a community. And this takes time. And it's good to have partners with you on board. And you can sort of use as a CVC your fund investments to improve your own direct investments. And there, of course, there's different ways of doing this. And everyone needs to make up their own mind. But you can, of course, use it in a way that you say, okay, for now, I focus on a certain area. But there's another technology area that is maybe still too early for us to do direct investments. So why not deploying a little bit of money into a fund that is only investing into this technology area, and then you see what is happening there. You get a look and feel about what works, what doesn't work, in order to maybe 2, 3, 4 years later do your own direct investments into this space, maybe even together with this fund in a follow-on round or whatever. So this is, of course, one of the possible logics. There's another reason, I think, to choose maybe funds that are really different from your own in the way of LP structures, because like VCs with purely institutional investors or so, they just also attract a different type of deal flow. That's just the fact. Yeah? There are different types of entrepreneurs out there and different types of deal flow. And it's just good to see also this piece of the market, yeah, to judge it against your own. And last but not least, if you're seeing also, you can learn also from these other funds, how they manage their funds, what tools they use, the way how they qualify stuff and so on. So many funds, if you go as an LP, if your ticket is sort of not too small, are willing to go the extra mile to actually have a really good cooperation. So there are many reasons why it can add a lot of value to actually invest into funds.
No, that's really interesting. And I think, up-and-coming CVC should take that on board. I know in certain emerging markets that's one of the kind of entryways people have in terms of educating themselves on how to invest into the market. I just want to ask, I have to let you go in a few minutes. So for the benefit of any kind of founders listening, and we always kind of do this on the show, what's the best way to get in touch with you? And when they get you in the room, what do you want to hear from their pitch?
Okay. How to get in touch with me? Well, I mean, there's not the one route, but it's very easy to actually ping me on LinkedIn, on my LinkedIn profile. So I will maybe not react within an hour, but I'm really sort of, I think it's a valuable network there. And it's good to sort of touch base there first. And then, well, the other way, of course, is dropping an email or getting in touch with the investment team and so on. I'm not on the transactions, like I'm not doing transactions anymore, even though I love to do that, but I'm not doing it anymore. That's what the investment team is doing. But yeah, it's quite easy to get in touch with us. You can also drop your couple of files or so through our website. Also there, it's very easy click to connect with us. So it's then maybe not me personally, but it's the team, and founders can be sure that we will have a look. So it's quite simple. I mean, we are, and never hesitate to just get in touch. If you're a founder in this area of infrastructure rollout, basically digitally, sustainably enabling the rollout of infrastructure, then we would love to hear from you. That's as simple as this. And yeah, and it's always amazing with sort of new solutions people are coming up with. It's just great. So this may be as the contact. Then about the pitch. For me, over the last years, I think there's two elements. I mean, first of all, it's like always, is we're all human beings. So it's sort of the way how you get approached, how sort of people engage and how they behave as human beings. I think this is something that we, of course, immediately register and see. And sort of this is very important to us. We're all human beings. But when you ask me more about the formalistic things, I think there are two aspects that are very important. First one is, I think for us, we must be able to buy into the vision of the founder team. So the longer term, so in 5 years or so, what do they want to be? Where do they want to be? What value do they really want to bring? What sort of solution is that they will execute? So this vision, I think we are an investor, and we all know there are many hurdles to realize this vision. So we need to be able to buy into this vision. But then comes a second piece, and this is where many, many startups have more problems to sort of perform. And that is the now. Now I'm working on these deals. I have this traction, and this is my burn rate, and this is how I manage it, and this is how I improve myself. And this is, you know, this sort of, well, constant panic mode is maybe sort of an interesting way of calling it, but this to be absolutely laser focused on the now and on the execution. So we know that execution is it all. And these are sort of these two things, these two elements. If we see them both, and still these are human beings that are friendly and that we like, I think then we're all in.
Perfect. And that's for founders. So what about corporates then? What can they do? Perhaps not EMBW specifically, but writ large, what can they do more of or a better job of to help their CVCs?
I think it would be great if sort of the corporations, like the top management of corporations, is just taking the word CVC by its name. I mean, in CVC, there's VC, and there's like 70, 80 years of experience in the VC business model and how it should be structured. So I think it's quite logic to do this step of saying, okay, also for a CVC, it is important to be as close to the cornerstone VC business model as possible, but then to combine it with sort of the advantages a large corporation can bring in addition. So a CVC is bringing a different angle to the market with the VC business model. And yeah, if this would be sort of more often realized and sharp realized, so really specific, because, and this is maybe my last comment, there are many different innovation tools out there for corporates. There's not just CVC. There's many others. And I have many times the feeling that they get mixed and that they get blurred and that it's not so clear. Is this now an innovation management? Is this for venture as a service like pilots or so, venture clienting? Or is this an incubation? Or is this an acceleration? What is this? And I think the worst the corporate can do is sort of mix it all. They should really make a clear decision on which instrument I want to use and why. But then this instrument, please, really as sharp as possible. Huh? If you want to do incubation, well, then do it. But then look on the best incubators and try to be as close as possible to this. And with CVC, it's the same. So because there's still many that are called CVC, but they are not really. It's more like innovation management. And I think it's also for the founders, it's very difficult when they see all these different units, what they have. I tried a couple of years ago, I had one post about sort of the 8-9 questions that a founder could actually ask a CVC in order to figure out what it is. Yeah, and there it's pretty simple. Yeah, it's not so complicated. And so if these setups would be clearer, sharper, I think that would help a lot.
Well said. Crispin, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Fernando. Thank you for your time. And it was a great pleasure. Thanks.
That is it from us today, folks. Don't forget to like and subscribe to the show wherever you listen to your podcasts. I have been Fernando Moncada. Our sound engineer is Mark Chatterley from In Ear Production. Go check out his work today at inearproduction.com. We'll be back again next week, as ever. Until then, have a good one.